And welcome everyone to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, Frank?
Doing well today, Nick. How are you doing?
Doing very good. Doing very good. We've got a really fun show today. We're lucky enough to be joined by Greg Yolen. And Greg is a film producer and writer, and he's probably best known for his collaborations with the writer and director Bill Condon. He's got a history as a producer. He's worked on the WikiLeaks drama, The Fifth Estate, which Frank and I are really big fans of. We're going to be anxious to get the chance to talk to him about that film. And he's also one of the producers on this summer's art house hit, Mr. Holmes, which has proven to be this summer's sort of counter-programming hit for discerning audiences looking for a real movie to see amidst all the CGI and superhero craziness. And in 2017, March of 2017, the upcoming live-action retelling of Beauty and the Beast is one of his current productions that he's working on right now. He's also a two-time Daytime Emmy nominee for his work on the television series R.L. Stine's The Haunting Hour. And he got his start working as an assistant to Bill Condon on the final two Twilight films. So he is also no stranger to the blockbuster machine as well. So welcome to the show, Greg. Thank you very much for joining us, as I know you're a busy guy right now.
Thank you, guys. It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, this is going to be great, man, because Nick and I are two huge fans of Bill Condon.
Well, and three of us on this podcast.
Yeah, man, this is super exciting. How did you get hooked up with Bill Condon?
Through friends and through Los Angeles. Just sort of one of those, lucky meetings that brought me into his world, and I started working for him as his assistant for a few years. And originally, actually, I was going to sort of come on as his assistant for this film about Richard Pryor that he'd been prepping from a screenplay of his, which is magnificent, like truly a beautiful screenplay. Maybe I thought his best when I read it. And we were all lined up to do it. I mean, this is a sort of a, circuitous way of getting into my work with Bill. But, I mean, we were lined up to do it with Eddie Murphy originally. And he was going to play Richard Pryor. He was really interested in that. And then Marlon Wayans was attached to it. And it sort of, it came together and fell apart and came together and fell apart, as so many films do before they end up getting made. Now it's actually come back together with Lee Daniels directing and maybe rewriting. It's not really clear, but anyway, instead of the Richard Pryor film, we ended up doing the Twilight movies, because that's Hollywood, and we ended up having a really good time on those. And then after that, just increasing my work with Bill, I started producing for him, and the first thing we did together in that capacity was Fifth Estate.
I remember when Breaking Dawn, the final Twilight movie, was going to get made, and the directors that were circling the project was obscene. I mean, obviously it was Bill Condon who eventually got to do them, but I think it was Gus Van Sant, mm-hmm. and I can't remember the other directors that was attached to it. And I remember when it was announced that Bill Condon was going to do the final Twilight movie, it was like, holy fuck. I should probably actually see this movie now. And people were kind of throwing a shit fit about it. And it was like, everybody relax. It's Bill Condon. We're good. Yeah. I mean, this guy did Kinsey, did so many great things. Dreamgirls, which I love.
Yeah.
I just remember. And then I remember when it was announced that the director of Twilight Breaking Dawn was going to do the Beauty and the Beast live action remake. And then people who had no idea who Bill Condon were upset that a Twilight director was going to do this movie. and it's like, just everybody chill out. That's here, all right?
The brutal irony of taking a bigger movie than the one before your last one is that more people will find out about you, but they'll only know you for that one thing.
Right, exactly. I'm very excited for Beauty and the Beast. I can't wait for that.
Yeah, well, the other director, by the way, the other director was Sofia Coppola. She was the other one.
Yes, that's right.
Was vying for it. It was a really interesting group of filmmakers, and I often think about what a Gus Van Sant or Sofia Coppola version of the Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn parts 1 and 2 would have looked like, you know?
A Gus Van Sant one would have had, I don't know the two main characters' names, but it would have had, like, Robert Pattinson and Taylor Lautner kissing at one point, I feel like.
Yes, it's Edward and Jacob, Frank.
Edward and Jacob, sorry, man. I'm so behind on my Twilight. I don't know what to say there.
You've had time to prep for this podcast. I don't know why you didn't read the series and then watch the film.
I'm sorry.
What I think probably has got to be really exciting for you as somebody who's, you know, you've made a couple films now and you're getting your start here as a young producer, and working with somebody as eclectic as Bill Condon, somebody who could make something like a Kinsey and then go to do something like a Twilight, which would have so much fan built expectation up around it. And in the pop culture, landscape, it's just massive. He's sort of able to bounce back and forth between really any story with a great sense of ease, and then able to bust out something that, like something like The Fifth Estate, where it was so propulsive and stylish and edgy, and it was almost like his Tony Scott movie in some ways. I mean, I know the cinematographer, also worked with Tony maybe there, on Taking of Pelham, so maybe some of that aesthetic, bled through. But I can't help but feel that Condon is a guy you can't really pin down. So to be able to be in his orbit as a producer, seeing the material that he's developing, my guess is there's probably, a little bit of everything.
Absolutely. And extremely well put. Eclectic is the word, and eclectic is exciting. I think a lot of filmmakers in one way or another make the same movie, every movie, and sometimes they come at the same story from different angles and it's satisfying, and sometimes it's repetitive and you're watching Transformers Dark of the Moon. But what was it? Dark of the Moon? Dark Side of the Moon? Dark Spot on the Moon?
Don't do that to Pink Floyd.
Michael Bay did it, okay? But no, Bill is, he is hard to pin down. And I mean, when we came off of Twilight, which sort of was one of those things, as I said, it was unexpected, but it was in a moment where there was a certain type of, zeitgeist around it, and it really did feel like we were stepping onto something that was going to be climactic and exciting for a huge group of people in a way that a lot of films aren't. I mean, it was an event in a way. There was something that was appealing about it going into that. And then coming out of that and really, the Fifth Estate, the Julian Assange screenplay coming up. And I mean, the Tony Scott comparison is apt. It's also, Alan Pakula or something like that. It's like we wanted to make a sort of journalistic thriller, something that was very much about, that said that there are big things going on in the world and that they, let's have a discussion about them, essentially. Coming out of Twilight, it seemed like the absolute, pole from the furthest you could get from that, which may or may not speak to the experience of making the Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn parts 1 and 2, it was exhausting making those movies.
And sorry, Frank, go ahead.
I was going to say, certainly, and just to touch upon The Fifth Estate, Nick and I always have discussions about topical films and topical filmmakers. Not necessarily that Bill Condon's a topical filmmaker, but he did make a topical film. Yeah. I tend to not like 95% of topical films that come out. And Nick, on the other hand, loves them, and we always get into arguments about, topical films. But I will say Fifth Estate is one of those movies that I absolutely loved, and I think that was an important topical film as opposed to what I view as many not being important or trying to capitalize on the current wave of whatever that topic is. But I think Fifth Estate's an important story to be told. Julian Assange's story is important to be told because there is so much spin in every direction you can look at it. And I don't think many people really know the actual story of him and WikiLeaks and everything. And I thought that The Fifth Estate was an excellent way of doing that.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm really proud of that movie, on every level. I think it's, your guys' podcast is very good about sort of, revisitation and reassessment of films. And I admire it for that. I think that's part of the fun of being a true film fan, is watching films at different points in your life and at different points in you know, the life of sort of the culture that is around you and seeing if they speak differently. And I think The Fifth Estate is a film that, because of its sort of built-in ambiguities and our attempt to really make a film that that was all about presenting questions instead of answers, and even as we sort of took you through the beginning days of WikiLeaks, not ultimately winding up in a place that that seemed conclusive about it, because it's a story that is very much being, you know, played out right now. That was something that hopefully will make it a film that sort of ages, because it continues to be about a debate that is ongoing, you know, as opposed to sort of like, I don't know where I'd come down on the sort of topical film issue, but I think that there are a lot of movies that certainly are made in a moment and feel of that moment and never escape that moment, you know?
Exactly. I think that was well put. I think Fifth Estate's essentially, you know, lack of a better phrase, a time capsule film where it's going to be timeless.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, certainly, you know, you strive to make something like All the President's Men or something like that, which is so, you know, so vital and looks good and feels good and is just like a thrilling movie, but is about, you know, a historical event. It feels so current. And that's, you know, that's the challenge of, I guess, making a contemporary, a topical film.
So as a producer, you know, what was the genesis of The Fifth Estate? Like, how did it come up, and sort of what were your, you know, first experiences on working on the film?
It came up, I mean, it was a project that DreamWorks had purchased a couple of books by people surrounding The Fifth Estate, surrounding The Fifth Estate. It was called The Fifth Estate from the beginning. Surrounding Julian Assange and the sort of the Guardian leak of the war cables and stuff. So it became a project sort of centering on specifically that, the leak of these hundreds of thousands of classified documents, because of, Chelsea Manning and, you know, her secreting them out, these diplomatic cables and Afghan war, cables. Out of a hard drive, you know, on a military base. So it was mostly about that story as it sort of, you know, as the script was being worked through. That was always imagined, I think, as the climactic central event of the thing. And so it was an Assange project without the, you know, approval of Assange, because it was based on underlying material that he had not, he himself had not created. You know, Assange, had dictated an autobiography at a certain point to a journalist whose name is totally eluding me, and I'll Google it. Andrew something.
Andrew Sullivan?
No, it wasn't Andrew Sullivan. It was Andrew something, not Sullivan. And then he completely disavowed it, you know, and so now there's, you know, he has his own unauthorized autobiography there, you know. So, you know, he's a character who sort of, he's a man who never really seems satisfied with the way that his story is being told by other people, and he wants to tell it himself, and he's very controlling about his own image. And ultimately it was the sort of contradiction at the heart of that I think drove the movie, that this is a man who's all about exposing secrets. But ultimately, he really doesn't want his own secrets to be exposed. I mean, and that was a sort of, we felt a really compelling basis for the character of Assange. And then Benedict expressed interest, and it just felt like, well, that's a movie you can really make, you know. And so that'll happen really quickly.
Dan, he's one of the true actors at the moment right now, so I would like to think that you guys are probably really psyched when he expressed interest.
Yeah, yeah, and this was, you know, right sort of as he was cresting on Sherlock, and it felt like really we got him right. This was the film he did right before The Imitation Game, which obviously got him his Oscar nomination, well deserved. I think he deserved one for Fifth Estate as well, but he really sort of felt like a great lateral move from Sherlock into this for him, you know, the idea of this very sort of, and then from there into Imitation Game too. It's the same type of character, the sort of reclusive, slightly antisocial genius. And he, you know, he plays it so well.
Okay. Let me ask this question then. What does a producer actually do?
Oh, man.
Not to call you out on it or anything.
I gotta go, you guys. I'm sorry. what does a producer do? You know, it's such an interesting question because it's what anyone who I ever meet sort of asks, and it's something that I personally ask myself a lot in a weird way. I never really intended to be a film producer necessarily starting out in the business. That's not, you know, if you ask me what I wanted to do when I was a kid, and it's always been my dream to go into film, I wouldn't have said producer. And I think that goes for a lot of people, you know. So it is sort of a weird position because you ask, you know, people who are going into film what they want to be, and they say, I want to be a, you know, filmmaker, I want to be a director, I want to be a screenwriter. And producer then sort of falls into this category where it is a lot of things. It can mean a lot of things, except it's not writer director, you know, like that's what you sort of know about it. Like producers can, there are many different types of producers and they all sort of represent something different, in terms of their specialties. For instance, you know, I'm working on Beauty and the Beast right now, which is just a massive film. And there are, you know, line producers who are the people who handle the budget. There are visual effects producers who are the guys who, you know, oversee the sort of the, you know, nuts and bolts of getting VFX shots in and, you know, knowing what vendors take those shots and all that stuff. And then there are, you know, producers like myself who just do nothing. I do absolutely nothing. I just sit around and and help myself to craft service all day. Honestly, you should see the assortment of gummy worms and bears and sharks that are out there. It's great to be a producer.
I can only imagine on
this sounds like a dream job for me.
It is. Yeah. It is a dream job. I'm telling you, there's soda all day, all different types of soda. There's just, you know, chips and nuts and crackers. It's crazy.
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, what I have done on different films, I guess, you know, to make it even more complicated, what I've done on different films is different. So sort of producing in my role with Bill is, I view it largely as, quality control. You know, I mean, it's sort of like making sure that everyone who should be talking to someone else about, you know, a design choice or, script ramification, you know, there are script changes and those have ramifications through the story. And you want to make sure that that gets, you know, translated into the every detail that's going into every frame. So it's sort of like, because I communicate with Bill, and then I sort of act as, you know, the lubricant to make sure that that information and the information, is passed between departments. That's sort of like, that's a large part of my job is to sort of be there and making sure that, everyone's talking to each other, which I do think is a key role on a film set because it is so many, there's so many people on a film set all doing such different things. And it's unlike an average workplace in that way, you know, it's not that everyone is sort of all on the same team and knows what the shared goal is. Like most of the people on a film set haven't read the screenplay, you know? So you have to sort of, you have to make sure that, that everything, that the hierarchy is standing so that the, if something has to be communicated in any frame of any shot, the cinematographer is able to tell his A camera and, you know, and focus puller, you know, exactly what he wants based on that conversation that he's had with Bill. And then, you know, that cameraman is able to, you know, make sure that all the grips and everyone knows how to move the crane to achieve that. I mean, it goes down and down and down into the smallest detail. And that's what you know, movies are made of, is just those tiny, tiny details. Which is the exciting thing about my job, is that I get to focus on that stuff. You know, I get to make sure that those little details are where they should be. And still, you know, it's not like I'm the one there fixing the stuff on the day. That, you know, that's the art director and the set decorator and stuff like that. So I just sort of, again, I hang out at craft service and I let them do their thing.
That's awesome.
But yeah, so I mean, to answer your question in very long form, like, producers do all sorts of things, and you can be a somebody who's given money to, you know, your friend who's a really talented filmmaker and you're a producer. You can be a you know, someone who holds underlying rights to a material, and that material gets made into a film, and you are sort of there shepherding it, and you're a producer, you know. So there are people like Stephanie Meyer, who are film producers, and she's, you know, a woman who wrote, you know, young adult fiction. I mean, it defies definition.
No, I was just saying, it's certainly a multifaceted hat. There is no one real thing that, you know, unless you're very, very specific, you know, like you said, like a line producer or concentrating on one thing. It sounds like most people who are in the producing realm are constantly needing to switch gears and, you know, and troubleshoot a variety of different things, which I can only imagine as being just, you know, a massive undertaking at times, especially when you would be going to work on a movie like Beauty and the Beast. I know there's got to be a ton of producers working on such a film, I would assume. But again, it just it sort of speaks to the level of organization that one must have, you know, to do that sort of job.
Yeah, I mean, it's organization is a good word for it, which, you know, depending on the project, can be pretty daunting. I mean, I have to say, on a film like Mr. Holmes, it's a little bit easier. There are just fewer elements. You know, there are fewer plates to spin. There are fewer actors. There are fewer locations. It's contained and it's quiet, and there's not too much by way of special effects or visual effects that you have to concern yourself with. So, you know, it is a I don't want to say it's an easier film, but it's a less complicated film than Beauty and the Beast. Absolutely. And you have to organize for them differently, you know, because each film is so different. I mean, Beauty and the Beast is an incredibly, I almost want to say, like, an unprecedentedly complicated movie in a lot of ways. It's sort of three very tough movies all at once, you know, one of which is a romance, and a romance that has to live up to pretty iconic standards, and a romance in which one of your characters is, you know, a fantastical animal. And then it's also, you know, a sort of state-of-the-art movie where characters interact with, you know, living objects, which obviously has a huge visual effects component. And then on top of that, it's a musical, which is really, really complex. And, I mean, it is hard. It is really tricky to make musicals. They're a very specific art form. And luckily, Bill is one of the people out there who really does know how to make musicals. So, you know, for my part, I went into this knowing absolutely nothing about how you could do that and what's required. And I've just kind of gotten to sit and watch Bill and a lot of people who, you know, are choreographers and are designers, and that's just been amazing to see too.
So this is a full blown musical.
Absolutely.
This cast is insane for this. I mean you got Emma Watson and Dan Stevens.
Yeah, Emma and Dan Stevens, yeah, as Belle and the Beast, and then you've got Kevin Kline as her father, Maurice. Yeah. He's, you know, and that to me is just such a mind blower. I'm such a huge Kevin Kline fanatic, you know, from Silverado when I was a kid, and all the way up to now. So yeah, he's fabulous. And then, you know, you've got the sort of the castle staff characters, for whom we just got an outrageous group. We got Ian McKellen as Cogsworth, and Ewan McGregor as Lumiere, and Emma Thompson as Mrs. Potts. And then we have a couple of new characters as well. There's a piano named Cadenza, who we got Stanley Tucci to perform, and then the wardrobe. Actually, she's not a new character. Madame Garderobe is played by Audra McDonald, who is, you know, I mean, she doesn't have too many film credits, but she is, you know, she's won more Tony Awards than any human being in history. She's an incredible singer and performer. So it's just like a sick cast. Oh, and then also as Gaston and LeFou, it's Luke Evans and Josh Gad. I mean, just rounding it all out, and they have their own crazy good good rapport. So it's really it's an amazing group of people to be making this huge musical with. Yeah.
I can't wait to see this.
I think you'll like it as much as The Fifth Estate.
Okay.
It's a very similar film to The Fifth Estate. You know, you've got the Beast. He's an embattled intellectual figure. he's in isolation, as Assange was and still is. You know, and it all comes down to, you know.
So who accuses the Beast of rape, then?
Belle, but clearly. I mean, that's the fairy tale. I mean, that's just going back.
Yeah.
You know.
I remember that from the animated movie. That's why I got nominated for Best Picture. Yeah, it makes sense now. It's all the pieces are getting put together.
It was a dynamite legal thriller in 1991, and we're hoping to update it who's telling the truth and who's not. I mean, is he her captor, or is she his captor? I mean, what's, you know, we're through the looking glass. It's messed up.
Is this going to be done in 3D?
Yes. Yeah.
Is it being shot in 3D?
No.
Post-conversion?
We had only 5,000 challenges on our hands, and so we ticked off 5,001. We're going for the post conversion on it. But you know, there's a difference between post conversion in 2015 and post conversion in, you know, 2011 or something like that, when you have Clash of the Titans being, you know, converted in 8 days or something like that. This is a pretty it's a long process, and it's pretty. Pretty cool, actually, what they're able to do just with the post conversion these days. You know, that said, I mean, it seems like unless you really, really want the film to live in 3D for its entire life, it's such a challenge from a production standpoint to shoot something in 3D for ultimately what still seems in 2015, or when Beauty and the Beast comes out in 2017. It seems like a lot of work to put into something that will only really affect that film's life for about, you know, 3 weeks by and large.
Right.
You know, you might get someone buying a 3D Blu-ray. And certainly I think that there will be an increase, you know, we're going to see more of that proliferating, you know, in years ahead with 3D technology at home. As of right now, it's just like not a lot of people do the 3D thing all the time. You know, there's no it's not a huge market, home or you know, or otherwise. It doesn't last that long. So yeah, I mean, we're doing the post conversion
with few exceptions. Yeah, it's kind of a gimmick.
I would agree with that, but you know, I also loved Hugo. You know,
yeah,
so
that was one of the best uses of it, for sure.
Yeah, and like I think that there are amazing ways to use the art that 3D allows for, and also, you know, like most things, people don't really take the time to do that. They do the sort of cheaper, more gimmicky version, and you know, it just takes that's sort of what I think it comes down to, is it takes less time to do a dumber film. And so I think that a lot of films that come out don't reach that high standard when they're entertainments, because you can just sort of, you know, you can make a dumber film faster.
and get it out there, and it makes the same amount of money, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of 3D, I don't know how I quite feel about it. I tend to see certain movies in 3D and then others not in 3D. But I mean, when I bought my 4K, I just bought a 4K TV, and I didn't get a 3D TV, but I have a 3D player. And I've specifically bought a couple of movies and, like, the 3D suite for, like, $5 or $10 more. Like, Hugo was one of them. Tron Legacy, and I think Prometheus was the other one that I got in 3D, just in case I get a 3D TV down the road. But I completely agree with what you're saying. It'll be interesting to see, like, Star Wars I'm certainly going to go see in 3D, The Force Awakens, because, I mean, I think that post-conversion 3D is going to be – actually, I don't know if they're shooting it in 3D or if it's post-conversion, but regardless – that's going to look so much better than probably 90% of the 3D movies that I used to see in theaters when 3D was, like, really hot after Avatar. And you're right, like, Clash of the Titans was coming out in 3D, and, like, everything was coming out in 3D.
Yeah, yeah.
Although Drive Angry in 3D, I will say, that's the only way to see that movie.
That's how Nicolas Cage designed it himself.
Yeah, exactly.
Every shot. I thought that Prometheus was gimmicky 3D. And
really?
Yeah, I do. Because to me, and I'm such a huge Aliens geek, but to me the update of the technology in that film seems so superfluous. It's like, okay, now instead of seeing things on a screen, they're all going to be floating in the middle of the room, and we can poke at them with our fingers, which happens, you know, which every 5 minutes someone is doing, and it just felt like, okay, so that's what you got. Like, there's your new thing for your 3D. Other than that, I didn't think the 3D was so.
I didn't see it in 3D. Unfortunately, I kind of wanted to.
Yeah.
I kind of thought it just added that, like, extra dimension while watching the movie, and it wasn't like shit popping out of the screen and, like, flying at you. It was just kind of like adding that other layer.
Yeah.
To bring you closer to the story, but I could see where you're coming from with that.
I thought, honestly, the best.
No, Drive Angry.
Hugo and Toy Story 3 I saw in 3D, and those were two films that really slayed with 3D. Totally great. I mean, you know, Beauty and the Beast is already sort of, it is already taking something that is 2D and bringing it into 3D. So I think if we, you know, if too many people saw it in 3D, it would be like 6D, or maybe I would have had like 9D. And then it would just be too much. So I think probably the way to see it will be good old fashioned 2D.
Yeah, I'm always
confused.
I'm so much more of a fan of seeing movies traditionally without the glasses on, you know, on your head. And, you know, I mean, when a cinematographer goes to the lengths that they go to craft a shot with everybody involved, and, you know, I just can't, and when it's post-converted, I can't help but feel even the best post-conversions are somehow in some way, you know, distorting with possibly the, you know, what the original artistic intent could have been. And when you have somebody, you know, like Tobias shooting, you know, the last, you know, as I believe the last bunch of movies that Bill has done, and he's shooting Beauty and the Beast. Yeah. I can't wait to see what he brings to it on a visual level, because he's been such a unique cameraman. He's, you know, worked on huge action films, you know, dramas, you know, now getting a chance to play in the Disney realm. What's it been like to observe Bill's relationship with Tobias Schleisler?
Yeah, Tobias is, I mean, he's, you know, just a total collaborator of Bill's. They work great together, and Bill, you know, really treasures him. He's a great, great DP. Tobias Schleisler is, you know, he's done, as you pointed out, you know, films with Tony Scott. He did the Pelham 1-2-3 remake, which, you know, wasn't good, but looked good. And he can operate in a very colorful, kinetic world. He also has worked with Pete Berg several times. I mean, he shot Battleship, which is not good, but also looks really good. You know, I mean, so and he also did Lone Survivor with Berg a couple of years ago. You know, another. So he does these incredibly impactful, you know, action films, and he's able to do that. And then his work with Bill is something that is that seems to exist in a another eclectic category. I mean, you know, it's kind of like Bill. I think Tobias is pretty eclectic in what he likes to shoot and what he's certainly what his talents are. He's multi-talented. You know, he really, for instance, like he really, really wanted to do Mr. Holmes. And he put other things aside to do a film that, you know, small and yet he was so set on shooting it that he did. And that is, you know, an amazingly beautiful film, I think. And
yes,
what
gorgeous.
How he captured that time and place and that house that we, you know, shot at in East Sussex in England. You know, it's unlike anything else on his resume, but he does it so beautifully. And then what he's shooting on this, I mean, it's pretty fabulous on Beauty and the Beast. I think you're going to be pretty, when you start to see the design of it and what we're able to shoot, it's pretty staggering. I mean, I'm excited.
Yeah, I've long been a fan. He shot Friday Night Lights, which for me is one of like the sports movies ever, and I thought that it was like the Black Hawk Down of football movies, and I absolutely love the aesthetic that he brought to the table there. And and like you said, to go from a Friday Night Lights to a, you know, a Taking a Pelham 1-2-3 to, you know, Mr. Holmes to, you know, Beauty and the Beast, it definitely suggests, you know, extreme range and the ability to sort of you know, take on whatever whatever material he's being presented with that he feels is, you know, worthy of his time. And he's able to put a nice, you know, really stylish spin on it without being, you know, overly obtrusive, you know, depending on what the director's original intent or vision was. We should definitely, you know, get into Mr. Holmes a bit because, you know, it's been a hit this summer, you know, in relatively limited release in relationship to obviously the Jurassic Worlds and, you know, Mission Impossible Fives. And every summer there seems to be one movie that catches on with, you know, adults and, you know, people looking for a good film to still see in the midst of all of the explosions. How did Mr. Holmes come about for you and Bill?
Well, it was something that had come to Bill four years ago. Maybe more than that. And it was just one of those screenplays that you sometimes read and you just think whoever gets to make this movie is going to make a great movie. You know, there are some screenplays that you do read and you think lucky them, you know. And that seemed like this one, particularly because as soon as Bill read it, he thought there's only one way to make this movie, and it's with Ian McKellen. And he basically called Ian up because Ian is a good friend from the days of Gods and Monsters. And really, they've, you know, remained very good friends since then. And he just, you know, sort of said, I'm going to send you this script tonight. And Ian read it immediately and, you know, called Bill up and said, well, that's a part and a half. And that was it. Like that, as soon as, you know, the alignment of Condon and McKellen came together, it was like, okay, we can get this movie financed. And it came together. We had to ultimately wait a little while for McKellen's X-Men scheduling to free him up for that last X-Men movie, Days of Future Past. But when everything sort of got in place, you know, it just felt like one of those movies that we were really lucky to get to make because it was sort of, you know, it was like a comfortable, lovely experience to be able to make that film with such great actors and friends too. I mean, that was the other sort of element was then Laura Linney coming in and she's, again, just a great friend of Bill's and mine. I mean, she's so great to have on any set. And then it was like going to summer camp or something like that in the most beautiful, you know, English seaside town you could imagine. It was a crazy good, fun shoot. And then, you know, a film that I think reflects the sort of the fun that we got making it, which is something that is an intangible that actually, you know, changes films. Like you can tell when people have enjoyed making a film. I truly believe that. So I think that one of the reasons that it's done well this summer is that it's like a really lovely film that people like living in for a little while, you know, with just terrific performances and then Tobias's beautiful work and Martin Childs, the production designer, I think also just, you know,
yeah, did
an amazing job. It was a wonderful effort by a lot of people.
Was the house built for the film?
No, it's a real house and an historic house in East Sussex, and it's really, yeah, it was exactly that. Actually, we had originally planned to shoot interiors somewhere else and make that the exterior house almost exclusively. And then when we went out there for our first location scout, you know, Bill and Tobias and Martin and myself and a few others all walking around it and just sort of saying, well, this could play as the kitchen. This is actually great for the kitchen. And, you know, why couldn't we set this scene in, you know, this corridor here? And just sort of going through the script and realizing that it could actually act as the house. And so we ended up shooting almost all of the house material in there. We ultimately built a couple of rooms to do longer scenes in, built them on stages. But the house was the house, and then on top of that, we got so fucking lucky with the weather. It was like crazy,
yeah,
crazy good fortune to be in England in that beautiful weather for that long. It did not rain on us, which it always does.
And I got to ask about the train stuff because, you know, in this day and age of CGI and how easy it is to just say, hey, give me a train over here, give me this over there. Some of those shots that you guys got of the train cutting through the landscape, those are so beautiful. And I'm wondering, you know, how you guys, I'm always wondering how people in movies get trains, you know, like, is it a running train, a real train? Is it a movie train? Like, is it something that you go out, you know, it's going to be out and you have a schedule. So you get the helicopter and you go get it. How does all that work?
The train in this case was fully computer animated. As was the performance, of the little boy. He is actually not real. We were toying with a sort of all digital boy effect, and so we went with that. And then most of the film is a lot of it is achieved through digital. The train is real. The train is totally real.
Okay. I'm just like, I'm sitting here. My wife is listening too. And her face was just like went white when you said that it was CGI because we're just like, oh my God, this is so beautiful. All right. Fair enough. Okay.
No, you can't fake that kind of English countries. Well, actually you probably could fake it. But no, we did the real thing. It was, you know, that was a helicopter unit that went out and, you know, there are certain in England, I mean, there are a lot of sort of older trains that run on tracks and there's a real tourism, a little cottage industry of people who are sort of train heads. I don't know what you would call them, trainers. So they ride on antique trains and we shot the opening of the film when he's arriving is shot at a station called Bluebell Station. It's a stretch of track that runs an old fashioned train back and forth and back and forth between these two antique stations sort of that are time capsules. And when we shot there, it was full. People were really, like, it does a big business. People really love riding these trains. So in that case, that was not that stretch of track. That was further off in the boonies, the English boonies. But we just, you know, basically there's a fantastic, I mean, there's someone for every effect. There's someone for every job in the film industry. And there is a guy whose name I don't know, unfortunately, who is just a helicopter shooter, and he does this stuff all the time. And he has a copter, and he goes out and he, you know, captures beautiful, sort of beautiful things. And really, he's sort of his own unit. I mean, not a lot of people go up in a helicopter. You generally, when you're shooting stuff like that. There are people who are specifically skilled to shoot from helicopters, and he knew that, you know, we set up the train. We knew when he was going to get there. We knew that the train was going to be at approximately this location. And he basically just went out one night and filmed it and sent us, we were done. I think it was in our last week of shooting, or maybe even after that, we might've already gotten back to New York to start cutting, and we got all the footage in, and it was just like, wow. He went out and I wish I knew his name right now, cause he killed it. Yeah, got beautiful stuff. And then we actually did also send a splinter unit to Japan to shoot some exteriors there for the sections of the film that take place in Japan. Yeah, it's like a small movie, but it has some real scope to it, which I think is a surprise.
And it's been a nice hit, too. It hasn't gotten lost amidst the, you know, the CGI chaos of all the superhero stuff, you know, which has been – you know, it's hysterical how the studios basically just shut down any sense of prestige, you know. And I'm not saying that, listen, there's been some great movies this summer. You know, Frank and I were huge fans of Mad Max. I thought that pretty much reinvented the action movie genre, and I don't really understand where it goes from here. There's always great stuff, in the summer. You have to really go out and find it. It's typically smaller things that get, you know, these low-key releases. But every year there's always one movie that seems to plug away. And I would have to imagine that you guys are all extremely excited that Mr. Holmes has sort of performed the way that it has.
Yeah, we're really happy. I mean, I think it's the danger of a film that is small and not sort of sensational in a way is that it does get lost. But you know, you want it to find its audience. And I think this film has largely found its audience in theatrical release. You know, it's done good business during the weekdays, which I think, you know, indicates, an older crowd, which, you know, I feel is so great because it's a film about being older. And not a lot of films these days are, certainly not, you know, you have sort of, you have your exotic Marigold Hotels, your sort of golden years comedies that sometimes come out and are fun. But, you know, films that I think take an honest and really emotional look at the things that are being faced towards the end of life, that's a unique thing. And I think that sort of it's gotten a lot of word of mouth from people who are glad that there's a film that that addresses it honestly and pretty, I think, warmly. You know, there's that's the thing that a lot of people have said to me after they've seen the film is that they're surprised how warm it is, which, you know, I think in part comes from the fact that it's about Sherlock Holmes, and you think Sherlock, you think, you know, incredibly intellectual, even cruelly intellectual guy, and, you know, that there's going to be a bloody murder and, you know, a plot twist. And it's not that. It's actually sort of a different genre from pretty much every other Sherlock Holmes film or story, which is it's not necessarily a mystery. It has a mystery at its core, but it's more a drama. It's a drama about Sherlock Holmes. So it's sort of it's a different type of film. And I think you go in expecting maybe that it's going to be Ian McKellen sleuthing around Victorian England, and it's
right.
And it's not that, for better or worse, you know?
So you are also a writer.
Yeah.
tell me about writing R.L. Stine's Haunting Hour, because when I was little, I read probably every Goosebumps book I could.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. I'm sad to say, I don't think there are going to be any more Haunting Hours. I think that the network, the Hub, was sold, and with it, all of the rights to those shows. But that was something where I actually co-wrote with my wife 4 episodes of the show, and we ended up, oddly enough, being twice daytime Emmy nominated for our contributions to those seasons. I mean, you know, it's fractional. There are a lot of different writers, and we contributed episodes that we'd co-written. So, you know, we got to benefit from a lot of really good writers. But I do think there was a lot of clever writing on that show, and really
you know, I grew up not only with Goosebumps, but there was also the show Are You Afraid of the Dark on Nickelodeon that, like,
yep.
You know, back when SNICK was the shit.
Yeah.
You know, I remember that show just totally terrifying me and always loving my entire life, you know, ghost stories and spooky stories, which I think a lot of kids do. I think kids have a built-in sense of the macabre. I really do. I think that kids are always looking for things, whether or not they realize it or not, that are subversive, and they have an instinct towards the subversive. So, you know, there are sort of, like, there are the best children's entertainment, I think, are still things that we all watch, you know, adults. And it's because, like, we look at them now and we're like, God damn, that was sneaky. Like, that was a sneaky movie. You know, it's, I mean, I look at, honestly, I look at Pee Wee Herman and, you know, I love him so much. And he's, you know, it was all about trying to get children to masturbate in Floridian movie theaters.
I'm right there with you on the subversive nature for kid stuff. I you know, that's always what I think it's funny. I've been watching a lot of movies of late from, you know, I'm a child of the 80s, you know, I'm 35. So the 80s movies were like my bread and butter. And, you know, I go back and I watch some of them over the last, you know, year or so. And I realized that the best ones were certainly the ones that had something to say underneath, you know, all of the shenanigans of, you know, the kiddiness nature of that sort of thing. So I certainly agree with you. And especially on Pee Wee, grew up on Pee Wee, absolutely brilliant, just hysterical. You know, it's like an acid trip for 8-year-olds. I mean, like, who doesn't like that? But I just think that, like you said, the R.L. Stine, you know, that world certainly, you know, like you said, it brought a sense of the macabre to kids who are always looking to get scared, no matter how much they don't feel like they want to be scared.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that made it incredibly fun to sit down and write. I actually, my wife had been working on it up in Vancouver, and she, you know, through the producers sort of, you know, started just talking about it. And ultimately we sort of pitched them a few things and they liked our ideas. I mean, it was really fun to just sort of sit there and be like, let's put ourselves in the mind of an 8-year-old and then think of something that would really, you know, freak us out. So we, you know, we wrote, the two episodes that we wrote at first, there was one about sort of that was a bit of like a teen, it was like teen comedy sort of thing where Cupid appears to a couple of, you know, teenagers and then of course screws with their lives. So it's sort of like a comic horror. And then the other one was really horror, I thought, where about a little girl whose father is away on a business vacation. She, you know, worries she'll never see him again. And then starts, you know, he's sending her these postcards and from all over the world, and she begins to sort of find these hidden messages in the postcards, which become more and more overt, and it's clear that there is something that's attached itself to her father and is coming back to her, so that now, you know, she's been wanting her dad to come back the whole time, but now she really doesn't want him to come home. So it's like that was like a really, I thought, frightening idea. And I loved, and it took like, it was so fast to write it because it was just like, you know, it seemed like something that I would have loved to watch as a kid. And so it was just like there, you know? So we had a great time writing those shows. And yeah, I only wish there were going to be more. You know, those kinds of shows are perennial. So I know kids will get their spook on somewhere.
Exactly. Obviously, Beauty and the Beast is a massive undertaking at the moment. Is there anything else that you can talk about that you guys are working on, and any, you know, or can you at least promise us that there's some new things coming up?
I can promise you. I don't know what they are.
Okay, fair enough.
But we might, depending on Benedict's availability, we could get into the Sixth Estate. I think that there's more. They're just sort of like, you know, we could shoot it in a day. It's just him and the Ecuadorian embassy just sitting around, just kind of like a day in the life of Julian Assange. He takes a shower. He, you know, he watches TV. He goes on the web. You know, he calls his attorney.
Barring that though, we don't quite know what's next, but you know, as you say, like Bill is he's very eclectic in his taste. So we're sort of, I think, the next one will probably not be another, Disney musical. But it might be, I don't know. Depends on, you know, what they're remaking by that point.
that's true. That's very true. The remake madness certainly seems to have no end.
I mean, I think that I think it's reached a fever pitch, certainly. But I agree with you guys. I mean, you know, it's hard to, you know, make a generalization like that as a negative thing, because, you know, then you get to Mad Max Fury Road and you're like, yeah, okay, that was a sequel or a reboot or whatever, and it was the best thing that's come out all year. So, you know, how can you say that sequels or remakes or redos in their own right are
when handled appropriately and with the right intentions, certainly. I you know, Frank and I are always talking too, just like, how come nobody ever remakes shitty movies? Like, how come you can't take like a movie that might have had a great idea, and I can't think of one off the top of my head, but you know, a movie that had a great concept but the execution wasn't great, why not remake that movie instead of, you know? But I you know, it's one of the things with Hollywood is that they want to know that when they're spending a lot of money, I'm assuming that a lot of times when Hollywood's going to spend a lot of money, they want to know that they're going to get some sort of initial return. There's going to be some immediate response. So when you are going to make, if you have to make a Beauty and the Beast movie, then let it be somebody like Bill Condon and have it be, like you said, a musical, you know, a romance, a drama, and make it something that's new and fresh and exciting for people to see. And I think that's really the way to approach it. You know, like we're looking forward to seeing, we just had on the show, Seamus McGarvey, and we're looking forward to seeing his, you know, he worked with Joel Wright on the new Pan, which couldn't look any more different than any other retelling of the Peter Pan story, while still trading on some of the familiar beats and story, you know, story elements and characters that we're also familiar with. But, you know, give us something new and fresh if you have to go down that, you know, the same well again.
I mean, everything you say is correct, especially the part about, I share your confusion as to why bad films aren't remade more often. I think it's like such a missed opportunity, because they all come out and we're like, okay, like let's all just sit down and discuss this film, and we things are written about it and podcasted about, and then you're like, all right, so we know what went wrong. Let's go back. Let's do it again. Let's get it right this time. You know, I think we've all learned a lot from The Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Let's just do over. And go and just collectively, you know, rescue it. Like that's what you do if you, you know, screw up a renovation of your house, or a franchise movie. Yeah, it's true. You do over. So why can't you just, you know, take the bad ones and make great movies?
It'll be interesting to see what Die Hard 6 looks like after the last one. oh my God.
Yeah. I think I watched that movie on Fast Forward.
Yeah, it just stopped being anywhere remotely related to the Die Hard universe. The last movie, it just didn't. I just couldn't figure out where the mentality was to have it be that way. Like John, if you were to like look at the evolution of the John McClane movie character through all of these movies, like he's now like a complete character of what was initially something that was relatively grounded and believable within its own context, obviously, and something that you could relate to. And like, you know, in the last one, he's like driving over civilians and like not giving a shit about like anything. And it's just like, I don't know where, you know, for me, the initial three all set. I haven't really needed anything.
The fourth one was good.
No, it wasn't.
I personally haven't did anything past three. I think three is amazing.
God, dude, come on, Timothy Oliphant's awesome.
But I've only seen four once, and I don't remember like jack or shit from it. I remember it being the PG-13, you know, Die Hard movie, which, but whatever. That's for another podcast. Greg.
No, wait, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about Die Hard for a second. Don't you cut me off before I've had the chance to Die Hard. Frank, you are so wrong. Die Hard 4 is so worthless. It is such a worthless piece of trash. I can't believe you would say that.
No, dude. Die Hard 4 is good.
No, it's not.
Compared to 5?
But here's the problem, though. I mean, okay, first Die Hard, the whole – it's what you're saying, Nick, like as to the evolution of the McClane character. Like he's – in the first man, he's the everyman, right? So that whole first movie coasts on the idea of average New York City cop getting into the most crazy shit ever. And it's so so wonderful and perfect and just like this guy with nothing but his balls is going to beat, you know, these professionals. So then the second one automatically disqualifies itself from anything like a character arc because the same thing happens to the same guy twice. And they say it in that movie, which makes it awesome because you're like, all right, like either you accept it or you don't. Like same things happen to the same guy. But it like completely blows the whole idea of the character, you know, in some way. That he's the everyman because he's not the everyman anymore. And then the third film I like too. I think it's clever and it connects to the first, which, you know, is great. But then it's like after that, it's just like you can't – like there is no arc for John McClane because John McClane is an impossible character, you know? Like there's no the whole idea of him is that he's the everyman. But with every film, he gets further and further away from that idea to the point where you can't make a movie about John McClane, you know, unless he's a dickhead superhero. Which is why it's easy to make movies about superheroes, right? Because they never have to change. They just keep on being awesome, and every movie they just – a new bad guy comes up and they kill that guy too. Anyway, Die Hard 4 sucked.
Well, I mean, I don't think that – I think Die Hard 4 is better than 2.
What?
But
what?
Come on. I'm sorry.
No.
Yeah, dude, I think it goes 1, 3, 4, 2 – and then obviously 5,
no, you know,
and then probably 6.
You know how I know you're wrong? Because the word fuck is never said one time in Live Free or Die Hard, which makes it a worse film than Die Hard 2.
Well, I have the DVD that has the unrated cut because the Blu-ray is only PG-13, and he says yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, before he shoots Timothy Oliphant at the end. So there is that. But no, I see what you're saying. But I mean, that's what John McClane's supposed to be. He's supposed to be like the American James Bond.
No.
Even though they've severely fucked it up.
The American James Bond. John McClane is the everyman. Indiana Jones is the super sexy world explorer guy.
But like the progression of McClane, he's not the everyman anymore. And I see where you don't like anything past 3.
But he's not even the everyman in 3. He's not the everyman in 2. He's only the everyman in 1. It's like in Death Wish, where Charles Bronson in the first one, he's a man who's something – he's pushed to the edge, and then he crosses the line, and then he gets revenge on all the people who, you know, raped his niece's boyfriend or whatever it is. And then every other film, he's just like – the line was crossed in 1, so now there are no more lines. Like, he can't, like, cross another line. He just, like, keeps on killing and killing and killing. To the point where in Death Wish 5, he's just like a guy who's killing a bunch of people. Like there's no idea of the character.
I do think that in Die Hard 3, they brought it back around to the everyman way more. You know,
yeah,
clearly,
because he's like this drunk asshole.
Yeah, like you know, I love 3. I think 3 is
awesome.
I think it's unbelievable. I think that the physical production is just ridiculous. Peter Menzies' cinematography is some of the fucking greatest action cinematography that I've ever seen in a movie. But what I loved about 3 was that you basically had a broken down, tired ass, drunk, like really hungover fucking McClane who has sort of resorted back to being that regular guy in the wife beater, you know, and like all filthy and dirty. You know, but yeah, I think that also too, the first 3 movies are made in a different time, in a different context of America, of cinema, of expectations of action filmmaking. And I think that the amount of time that went on between Die Hard 3 and Die Hard 4, there was a slickening of everything in the aughts, I think. The grittiness of a lot of action films went away with exceptions, of course.
Of course.
But the McTiernan aesthetic, which is so awesome on a very macho, gritty, you know, in your face sort of, you know, style, that was replaced with more of like the, you know, the beification of everything, where everything is all gleaming and glistening. And I just felt that for me, the fourth one just didn't have the edge that I wanted it to have. And then the fifth one, I just was like, this is a cartoon. Like, this isn't even in the same realm, you know? And I think it also speaks to where people are as the viewing habits. I just think that most people have been really like, you know, video games. I think that video games have done a disservice to the action film genre, because so many people have become so involved with those first person shooter games. And I never did. Like, I never got into that stuff. Yeah. So, you know, my video game expertise ended with Super Nintendo. You know what I mean? Like, I'm illiterate with computer games, and I have no idea, you know, the impact that that realm has had on the action film has changed it in a very unique way.
No, I think it's just that action films aren't very good anymore.
Well, there's that too, but I don't think there's any question that the grittiness of the 90s action films is largely absent in most of your mainstream action films these days. I mean, like, you don't have Bruckheimer making anything badass anymore, really. Like, now that maybe he's over at Sony, maybe we'll get some crazy shit again, you know. But like, I just like, you don't have Walter Hills making movies, you know, anymore. I just feel like the video game component to everything, for me, just it just changed the landscape of things. And I also agree to your point, Frank, that, you know, there's a lack of quality in most action films from a writing standpoint. Unfortunately, it just seems to be all about the set piece. So, you know, but things change, you know, aesthetics, you know, they evolve over time. And, you know, you have all of your, you know, all of your great, you know, visual stylists who are pushing things further and further. So I can tell, Greg, that you're a big movie buff, and just chatting about movies is something that you like to do.
Yeah, to say the least.
Well,
it's sort of all can talk about it all. I mean, it's not like there's no choice.
It's all good. On that note, after Nick's epic monologue about action films, I just want to say thanks for coming on, man, and you're more than welcome to come back anytime to talk about any movie.
Well, it's been great chatting, guys, and yeah, I mean, I just love that you guys love movies. I think that it's such a good there's so much sort of negativity out there, but, you know, just talking to a couple of guys who really enjoy watching movies, I mean, like I said, it's the best. It's so much fun, and it's such a privilege to make movies and watch movies and talk about them. It's just the best.
Couldn't agree anymore. Thank you very much for coming on the show and talking about, you know, the beginnings of your career, which obviously has been excellent. And, you know, like as Frank said, we'll definitely have to have you back on in the future. And, you know, yep.
I'll check back with you guys after Beauty and the Beast. How about that?
Perfect.
Great.
Anytime.
Okay, good.
Good luck.
All right, thanks. Yeah, good luck, man.
Okay. Take it easy. Thanks.